Words on Water.
Welcome to Words on Water, a podcast from the Water Environment Federation. I'm the host, Travis Loop. 2017 marks the 45th anniversary of the Clean Water Act. This law is obviously so central to the work of the water sector, to all of you. So I wanted to have someone on the podcast who could talk a bit about the origins, the history, the changes, the future of the Clean Water Act. So I'm very happy to be joined by Ken Kaposis. He has almost three decades working in Congress at a very high level, senior positions on the staffs of both the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure and the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. Ken also spent several years at EPA as the chief official for the Office of Water. And this year he taught water law at American University and will be doing that again next year. So Ken, thanks for carving out some time to come by.
Well, thank you, Travis. Thanks for inviting me to participate. It's good to see you again.
Yeah.
Very much appreciated all the work that you did for EPA during your time there when our careers overlapped.
Yeah, that's the disclaimer I forgot to throw in there is that when you were the head of Office of Water at EPA, that I was the communications director for you. So that's how I knew that you'd be a great person to have come in and talk about the Clean Water Act. I think people will be really interested to hear the history, especially kind of pre-1972. What was happening in the country that ultimately led to the 1972 legislation?
Well, the great industrialization and population growth that was occurring in the 1900s in the United States, people looked upon our rivers, lakes, oceans, and streams as a place to dispose of their waste. And as this growth occurred, it was becoming more and more apparent that the ability of those waters to absorb that waste just did not exist. Famously, when Lyndon Johnson came to Washington as president, as a senator, he referred to the Potomac as an open sewer. There were further instances, most famously have been reported, often reported, are when the Cuyahoga River in Ohio caught fire, when Life magazine ran its cover story that said Lake Erie was dead.
Mm-hmm.
There were multiple beach closures. There were pollution was just everywhere. And of course, it was the 1960s into the 1970s that people in this country had decided that they had enough.
Hmm.
It was the great heyday of all of our current modern environmental statutes, whether it was the Clean Water Act. Between the very late 60s and the early 70s, Congress put in place the Clean Water Act, mm-hmm. Clean Air Act, the Solid Waste Disposal Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Endangered Species Act. So really that the heart and soul of our environmental protections came about as a reaction to the pollution that people saw all around them.
And EPA was formed in 1970?
EPA was formed in 1970. Yeah. It was formed by executive order by President Nixon then at the time. That's one of the shortcomings that EPA has. There is no generic statute establishing EPA. So it exists by virtue of executive order and then implements the variety of laws that Congress has enacted.
Interesting. Okay. So there was this public outcry to do something about the pollution that was rampant everywhere. And members of Congress actually responded to that public pressure. And the Clean Water Act wasn't a brand new piece of legislation. It was actually amendments to
That's correct. The modern Clean Water Act that we refer to was enacted in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
It was a complete rewrite of the Federal Water Pollution Control Act of 1948.
Okay.
That act had been in place. It had been amended several times, but it had very few teeth, and it was extremely cumbersome to implement.
Yeah.
It was a statute that was water quality based, and that's the term that's used in that you would determine what the pollution problem was that a water body was suffering from. Then you'd have to go through and determine what the sources of those pollution would be, and then you'd have to come up with individual strategies to address them.
Hmm.
The beauty of the 1972 Act was they recognized that this system simply did not work, and that instead Congress put in place a system where all similarly situated discharges, whether it be industry or municipalities or whomever might be discharging waste into the waters, would have to meet the same standard irrespective of the quality of the water. And so you really leveled the playing field, but you leveled it by raising it. And that was the beauty of the people who drafted the 1972 Act.
Okay. And, you know, the you hear about the classic goals of fishable and swimmable and the chemical and biological integrity of the water. I mean, what's could you kind of summarize better than I just did what the crux of the clean, what the goal really was of that legislation?
Well, you're pretty close. The the objective of the act is to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. It's a very broad and ambitious goal, particularly when you think about chemical, physical, and biological. Often when people look at the Clean Water Act, they kind of gloss over the physical integrity of those waters. But there are physical characteristics beyond just merely the number of chemical pollutants that might be in the water. And of course, that objective includes restoring and maintaining biological integrity. So bringing species back that have been either eliminated from water bodies or threatened. So those are all considerations that the agency takes into account when they when the agency implements the Clean Water Act. And as you correctly stated, it has an overall goal of making waters, it actually doesn't say fishable and swimmable, but everybody in the business for the last 45 years talks about fishable and swimmable. I can't even quote to you exactly what it says, but it is it's to make the
unofficial
waters,
tagline there.
It is to make the waters suitable for both human use and for environmental purposes. And that's really what the Clean Water Act is about.
And so, you know, there's all the various sections of the Clean Water Act. What were and what are the key kind of mechanisms there for trying to improve water quality?
Well, probably the key sentence in the entire statute is the first sentence of Section 301, which says, except in accordance with, and it lists a handful of sections, the discharge of a pollutant into the waters of the United States is prohibited.
All right. Period.
Period. All right. Now, it does say except as provided in. And, of course, there are people that are able to get permits, and some of those permits do allow for certain amounts of pollutants to be discharged, but they have to be an amount that's either in accordance with the standards that the agency has set or that meet the requirements of the receiving water, the water that's getting it. So I would say that in and of itself, that's the first point. The second is language that's also in Section 301 that discusses the different kinds of standards that the Clean Water Act requires. And first and foremost in those is the even technology-based standards that I referenced earlier. If you are, for example, if you are a metal finisher, you're going to have to meet this standard. It doesn't matter whether you're in Ohio or you're in New Jersey or you're in Texas. And it doesn't matter how clean or how dirty the water is that you're discharging into, you are going to have to meet that certain technology standard. There are, and in setting those standards, the agency is tasked with looking at what's the best standard that's available. And it's the best available, the general standard under the Clean Water Act is best available technology, economically achievable. So, it has to be something that's affordable. But if you look at the legislative history of the 72 Act, even there you will find that the authors of the statute and Congress in its legislative history stated that they recognized that economic achievability didn't mean that everybody in the country could meet that standard. They recognized that some businesses, individual businesses, may have to go out of business because they would not be able to meet those standards.
Oh, very interesting.
There are some other standards that, such as best conventional technology. The Clean Water Act is replete with terminology about what standards need to be met. But the overriding requirement is what's the best that you can come up with, and it doesn't mean the best absolute, but it's something that the target is always best.
What about, questions popping into my head, what about, how does the Clean Water Act handle the relationships and the responsibilities between the federal government, states?
Thank you for asking that question. There has been a great evolution. When the Clean Water Act was, the 72 Act was put in place, it supposed that states would have the opportunity to take over a huge number of the responsibilities under the Clean Water Act. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, states are involved in determining how clean is clean for a water body. States develop water quality standards under the Clean Water Act. And a water quality standard consists of a designated use. That is this a water body supposed to be suitable for swimming? Is it supposed to be suitable for a healthy trout population? Mm-hmm. What is the use of that water? Is it supposed to be suitable as a drinking water source? Often a drinking water source after appropriate treatment. So the state sets those standards. EPA develops the information called water quality criteria that are used to say, okay, if you want to have, say, a healthy trout fishery, what's the maximum amount of copper that can be in that water and still have a healthy trout fishery? So EPA would provide that information. And then the states would combine the designated use with the water quality criteria, and then there you have a water quality standard. But it's up to the states in those first instances to decide what the use of their waters are going to be in those states. The act also contemplated that the states would have the opportunity to be the primary entity for issuing permits for discharges under the Clean Water Act. And since 1972, 46 of the 50 states have taken on that responsibility. EPA is the permitting entity in only 4 states. Mm-hmm. Some of the territory's possessions, some areas in Native American or Indian country.
Okay. Interesting. So the actual passage, was this it's a funny word to use these days, a bipartisan effort that kind of got this rewritten and put forth?
Well, it was highly bipartisan. Mm-hmm. In both chambers, both House and Senate leaders supported the passage of the bill. The 72 Act was vetoed by President Nixon.
And why did he do that?
Well, in the veto message, he objected to the amount of money that the federal government was going to provide to municipalities to upgrade their sewage treatment plants. Mm-hmm. It provided multiple billions of dollars and to meet new requirements that the act was going to put in place, and he objected to that money. And he also objected to the federal government being more involved in pollution, saying that it was more of a local problem and not a national problem, which, of course, anybody knows water does not respect state boundaries. It might form a state boundary, but it does not respect state boundaries.
Sure.
So then following that, the president's veto, Congress overrode that veto very late in the session in 1972, just prior to the election, and did so by an overwhelming margin.
Okay. And then, so what were those early years like? You mentioned the infusion of funding to address, wastewater in particular, and you hear about a great deal of progress that was made because of that. So what kind of happened in those early years?
Well, it was very interesting and trying times for the agency. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned earlier, EPA was formed in 1970. This law was enacted in 1972. So you're talking about a fairly new agency. Now, the government wasn't new to the business. There were people prior to the formation of EPA that were implementing the old Federal Water Pollution Control Act. Mm-hmm. But the agency was given a whole slew of new responsibilities to work with the states, to develop standards, to develop information and criteria. They also had to, the agency also had to then determine how to get this money out to the states in a rational way. Mm-hmm. Congress did provide a formula for how much each state would get, mm-hmm. but of course, in sending money out from the federal government to the state, the federal government doesn't just write a check. And so rules and regulations and what was eligible, what was not eligible needed to come up and be developed. That was further compounded by President Nixon, not content to have his veto overridden, decided that he still didn't want to spend the money. So he decided to impound the money and say, I have the ability as president to not spend money that Congress has appropriated. Well, that actually went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and President Nixon lost. Mm-hmm. And also, it was a primary reason that the modern statute that governs the budgeting process exists, the Budget Control, and I'll probably get the name wrong, Budget Impoundment and Control Act, I believe is what the name of it is. And that was enacted in large part because of the impoundment of these wastewater funds that Congress had provided. Wow. And interestingly enough, from a legal standpoint, I believe the president signed that law into force before the Supreme Court had ruled on whether he had the authority to impound the funds. And this was a law that took away his authority to impound the funds.
Huh.
And so he signed that law, and then the Supreme Court ruled against him.
Okay.
So that got pretty well settled coming in those early years following the Clean Water Act.
Okay. And then once that was somewhat resolved, then money did start going out, and municipalities really started to address, you know, the wastewater issue. That's really one of the big successes, I guess, of the Clean Water Act, of those point source, addressing pollution at the sources, at the end of the pipes, and being able to deal with that.
And that was clearly the priority that was on Congress's mind at the time of the Clean Water Act's passage in 1972. It was upgrading the discharges from municipalities. Mm-hmm. Typically, it was upgrading from what was called primary treatment to a form of secondary treatment. Which was more effective at getting the pollutants out of the water before it was discharged. And that was done with a significant amount of federal financial assistance. Mm-hmm. The federal government at that time was paying 75% of the costs of municipalities to do that.
Wow.
The second component was the regulatory component, which was the constraints on other non-municipal dischargers, so industry, manufacturing, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And those were controlled through the regulatory mechanism. There was no federal financial assistance other than the indirect assistance, of course, that always occurs during using the tax code as a business, gotcha. As a legitimate right. business expense.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Interesting. And then I guess kind of, did that create a lot of jobs and economic activity? I mean, maybe that's an obvious answer, yes.
Yes, very, very much so. It was a huge undertaking in the public works sector, which would bring in most of the same, no matter what the form of public works is. So you have a lot of employees, operators and engineers. You would have people in the design work. You'd have actual construction, concrete, steel, all that you would expect in those kinds of construction projects, but mm-hmm. it created thousands of jobs.
And those jobs haven't gone away either. They've hung around. You
know? Well, they have hung around in the sense that obviously the number of people involved in construction of a treatment plant is more than is needed to operate.
Mm-hmm.
But as has long been the case, one of the great aspects of investing in America's infrastructure is that is a job that you cannot outsource.
Mm.
It has to be somebody here that actually does it. So the number of jobs and the economic positives that have come out of the federal investment over the years under the Clean Water Program has been immense.
Okay. As the Clean Water Act went on in age a little bit, I know there's some amendments made. What was going on that led to those amendments? What kind of changes were made? In response to what was going on?
Well, if you look at the history, after the law was put in place in 72, again, the drafters expected that they would need to revisit the statute because with any major new statute, Congress tends to revisit it.
Mm-hmm.
What worked well, what didn't,
mm-hmm.
How could we make it work better? How could we simplify something or how could we strengthen something? So then there was the law was amended in 1977.
Okay.
During the 1977 amendments, there was a large emphasis placed on the control of toxics pollution. And what the nation had found was that the agency either didn't have the correct tools or didn't create enough of an emphasis on controlling toxic discharges. A particular concern were bioaccumulative toxics. Those are the ones that work up through the food chain.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets into a little critter that is eaten by a bigger critter that's eaten by a bigger critter.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually you get very unhealthy amounts. Probably the one that most people are familiar with is the accumulation of mercury
mm-hmm.
in fish.
Okay.
That's common for fish advisories. Mercury is a persistent toxic that's bioaccumulative. So So there was a large emphasis on toxics. There were some other changes that were made to the statute, but that was probably the most significant one.
Okay. And then later in the 80s, weren't there some further changes? Or
there were. Okay. There were. The next significant change to the program was in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
That effort actually began several years prior to that, but didn't make its all the way through Congress. It actually made its way through Congress in 1986, and President Reagan vetoed that bill. I believe it was a pocket veto. Actually, as I think of it, it may not have been, but he vetoed it, and Congress did not have enough time to override the veto at 1986. So in 1987, that bill was reintroduced in the House as H.R. 1. For those of you who are familiar with how Congress works, usually the first 10 bills are reserved for things that are very high priority.
Mm.
In the old days, they used to, on the first few weeks, they'd actually do 1 through 10. Nowadays, they hold on to those numbers. So H.R. 5, for example, might get introduced 8 months into a Congress. But
when they decide there's something worthy of that.
They decide it's a big priority. Mm-hmm. So it was introduced as H.R. 1. It was passed in both the House and Senate in the first week of Congress with a large majority again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the president vetoed it again. Mm. Objecting again to the money,
mm-hmm.
and he also objected to the new non-point source program that was in the statute. Congress took up the veto override, and the House acted first because it was a House bill, and then the Senate acted second, and on February 4th, 1987, the Senate overrode the veto, and the 87 bill became law.
Okay, and the big provisions of that bill were the non-point source program. I mean, that was
the non-point source, which was the new program under new Section 319,
mm-hmm.
was written into the statute, but it was written in as a non-regulatory program.
Mm-hmm.
And when you had asked earlier about the role of the states, the non-point program really emphasizes the role of the states.
Mm-hmm.
It called for states to come up with plans to address non-point sources. It provided, the law provided a modest amount of money to help states implement those.
Mm-hmm.
And the that program, again, was intended to be revisited to see how well it would work. There was a feeling among some that it would be a good first step, but it would not be effective in actually addressing non-point source pollution. Non-point source, of course, being something that enters the waters, but not from a pipe or a ditch or something like that.
Off of fields or off of streets,
right?
Those kind of things, not mm-hmm. a pipe. Yeah.
And you mentioned streets. Well, it also created the stormwater program for municipalities, starting with the larger municipalities. It was supposed to be a tiered program, phased in over time, starting with communities over 250,000. Then the next group of communities would be over 100,000. And today, it mostly affects communities over 50,000.
Mm.
So the communities of any good size are brought into the stormwater program.
Okay. SRFs, when were they born?
SRFs were created in the 1987 amendments.
All right.
They were in response to a longstanding view by some in the executive branch that it was time for Congress to get out of providing grant money to the states. In the early 80s, in fact, President Reagan had proposed eliminating the grants.
Hmm.
And as part of a deal cut with between the president and the Congress, the construction grant program was reduced from a 75% federal grant to a 55% federal grant. Then President Reagan wanted to end it all together. Congress still saw very large needs in communities and said, what we will do is create the SRF, the Revolving Fund Program, where Congress would provide the seed money, and that money, though, would then be lent to communities at market rates and preferably below market rates. And there's been some changes made to that to make it even more attractive.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually get below zero in terms of rates.
Mm-hmm.
The But that money then would be repaid to these funds, and it would allow these funds then to be lent again and again and again. And so well over 50 or more billion dollars has gone out. I don't recall the exact part, but it's a substantial amount of money has gone out under those programs.
Sure. Any other between then and before now, any other big developments we're missing that were any other amendments or moments to note?
Well, there have been a variety of tweaks to the law over the years. I would say that since 1987, most of the amendments that have been made to the statute have either been to create more site-specific programs. For example, programs such as the Long Island Sound Program or such as that. So more geographic-based programs. Chesapeake Bay Program was created in the 87, put in the statute in 87. EPA had actually begun the Chesapeake Bay Program sometime before that. Or the amendments have been to address requirements that seem to be more difficult to meet, shall we say. EPA had come up with the combined sewer overflow policy. Congress enacted that into the statute a few years ago to make it clear that that the mere existence of this policy did not create a vulnerability for communities in how they address combined sewers.
Interesting. So I guess looking back and looking at where we are, there's obviously a variety of opinions out there depending on what type of organization or entity or individual you are. But what are some of the most commonly held views on the pros and cons of the Clean Water Act? If you're kind of trying to sit back and do a bit of an analysis, what do people say has done well, that it's been good for?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the quality of the waters nationally has improved dramatically since the late 60s and early 70s. The states do regular analysis of the quality of their waters, and they report that information to EPA. EPA consolidates that information and publishes it. These water quality reports done by the states indicate that the number of waters that they've assessed that meet their own water quality standards has doubled since 1972. Now, that in and of itself sounds like a great amount of success, but the amount of waters that were meeting those standards in 72 was about 1 out of 3.
Gotcha.
So we're now at about 2 out of 3.
Okay.
But so if you look at it, it's yes, we've doubled it, but we're only halfway there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as I said, there's no doubt that there have been vast improvements in water quality.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the difficulties, of course, in improving water quality is that the population keeps growing.
Mm.
So the stress on the system is increasing. So so you have this constant effort just to maintain the status quo. And unfortunately, that's kind of where we are.
Mm-hmm.
There has not been a significant noted increase or improvement in water quality in about 20 years in this country. There's not also been a noted decrease in water quality. There are some new issues that continue to arise, new in that they become more serious and severe. They're not necessarily unknown. Clearly, from a water pollution standpoint, we've done a pretty good job of addressing what comes out of municipal wastewater plants and what comes out of industrial plants. There are still some areas that more could be done. I'm a little bit concerned that one of the most significant efforts of the last administration's EPA to control wastewater discharges was for the steam electric power industry that was going to remove tons of pollutants out of the system. And
I
the agency,
$1.4 billion per year of toxic pollutants.
Toxics and nutrients. And these are not obscure things. These would have been mercury and arsenic, selenium, well-known things that are harmful to humans and to animals. So so hopefully, as they revisit that, they'll look at the wisdom of keeping it in place.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still quite a few steps that need to be taken. Nationally, the largest remaining source of pollution is non-point source mm-hmm. pollution. So,
and that's where people would say the Clean Water Act kind of has fallen short or wasn't set up or drafted to really address non-point in the manner that it needs to be.
Well, it isn't currently drafted to do that. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, the 1987 amendments that established the current non-point source program, when that was being put together, it was with the intent that after the states have done these plans and the states have undertaken certain efforts to try to address the non-point source pollution problem, that they would then come back and Congress would have the opportunity to work off of that information and decide, well, what's the next step that needs to be taken?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't necessarily mean that it had to be a permit regulatory mm-hmm. program like we have for point sources, but was there something more that could be done? Because while there have been some non-point source success stories, nationally, the amount of success in addressing non-point source is relatively small.
Mm-hmm.
So it remains again, I speaking nationally because local water bodies, it can differ what its biggest problem might be.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the data nationally, you'll see that the biggest problem is addressing non-point source. Mm-hmm. It is the largest reason that water bodies do not meet their water quality standards.
Well, and you know, we mentioned a few things about what non-point source means with coming off streets and rooftops and you know, not out of a pipe, but you know, agriculture is one of the big categories of non-point, and that's where, you know, the Clean Water Act does have a regulatory approach to large animal agriculture, but not to crop agriculture and that type of thing. And that's where you do have non-point source pollution. So
correct. Large animal feeding operations are point sources and regulated under the Clean Water Act. Congress specifically put large animal feeding operations in the definition of what would be regulated.
Mm-hmm.
But row crop agriculture is, from a water pollution standpoint, is largely unregulated. There is no regulatory tool for the federal government or state governments under the Clean Water Act. Mm-hmm. States are, of course, free to do whatever they choose to do under their own state law.
Mm-hmm.
Some states have become more aggressive in trying to control runoff by requiring filter strips, requiring different timing of the application of fertilizer. For example, a lot of farmers use natural fertilizer or manures mm-hmm. as a fertilizer. Don't put that on the ground when the ground is frozen, for
mm-hmm.
example,
mm-hmm.
because it won't go in. It will simply run off as soon as it rains or the snow melts. Filter strips, as I mentioned, some states are using those. They have proven very effective at slowing down and capturing pollution before it can run off.
Mm-hmm.
Increasing technologies on the application of fertilizers or pesticides
mm-hmm.
that could get into the waters. There are some things that are that states are looking at and states are working on,
mm-hmm.
But the application of those technologies and requirements are by no means uniform. And as I say, it remains the largest problem. So there's still more work to be done there.
Yeah. Speaking of more work to be done, I guess, and this is perhaps the most challenging question of our conversation, is looking into the future here, where you think the Clean Water Act might go, might be modified in the future. And again, that's really difficult given kind of the political landscape these days, but do you see any areas, maybe not in the near future, but 5 years from now or whatever, where there could be some efforts to change things in the Clean Water Act or to add things?
Well,
I mean, has there actually been any real kernels or inkling around changes like that?
I am not optimistic that there will be a revisit of the Clean Water Act in the way that there was going from the 72 to the 77 to the 87 Act.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that the Congress has the stomach for it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that, and I think that if the statute is opened up to amendment,
mm-hmm.
what we'll find is that requirements will be diminished
mm-hmm.
and not increased. I think that the Clean Water Act has a lot of tools in it that are sometimes used better than others by either the federal government or by the states. we talked at the very beginning about the objective. The Clean Water Act also has in its first section a goal of the fishable, swimmable goal is, I believe, 1983. Mm. And the elimination of the discharge of pollutants by 1985.
Wow. Elimination. Right. Elimination. Just stressing that word.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a zero. So, and in the various sections I was mentioning earlier about putting in requirements for things, the statute does give EPA in many places the authority to go to a zero discharge. Mm. Now, the agency doesn't do that. Mm. I think that so I'm not real optimistic about revisiting the Federal Clean Water Act. I think it's unfortunate because I think that it would benefit if people could take an objective, rational look at it. But that doesn't seem to be the kind of conversation that we can always have today. I think that that we are in more of a reactive mode. Mm-hmm. I think a good example is recall a couple years ago when. In August, when Toledo couldn't drink their drinking water mm-hmm. Because of algal blooms in Lake Erie, mm-hmm. The algal blooms it's pretty simple. They are a result of excess phosphorus and nitrogen entering the system mm-hmm. that was coming from agricultural lands in the in Ohio. Mm-hmm. All right, so now obviously there was some that was already in the system that was flowing from someplace else, but. Through the Great Lakes system, but the bulk of it was coming out of Ohio. So then the question is, well, what does Ohio want to do about that? Mm. Ohio could be much more aggressive in controlling runoff from farms if it chose to. Mm-hmm. But what you've seen is a balance that's been developed between trying to undertake less strict regulatory methods against farmers, and then coupled with trying to make sure that people are more aware of the presence of these harmful algal blooms so that they can treat the water before it gets into the system. Mm-hmm. Now, I would argue that treating contaminated water is not money well spent. Money well spent is preventing the contamination in the first place. Yeah. And so we live in a world where some elements of society are allowed to export their pollution. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is non-point. Mm-hmm. And so they export it and they make it somebody else's problem. Mm-hmm. That was also the theory behind when the Des Moines Water Works sought to recover from upstream dischargers for nitrogen pollution. The Water Works was spending several million dollars a year to treat for these nitrates in the water. Mm-hmm. And their attitude is, why should I treat for it when you can prevent it in the first place? Mm-hmm.
That old adage about an ounce of prevention, right?
It is an ounce of prevention. It would work. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you're going to see the federal government be able to step in. Particularly, I've not seen signs of that in the current administration. So what we're going to be living with is how are the states going to react to the problems that they face. And as I mentioned earlier, water doesn't respect state boundaries.
Yeah.
So you get this situation where you have to have an arrangement where the upstream and downstream states recognize that we're all in this together mm-hmm. and that those resources need to be protected.
Yeah. Well, that's a great place to wrap this up. Terrific conversation, very informative. Again, thanks for taking some time to chat about the Clean Water Act in the year of its 45th anniversary. So,
well, we all hope we can be around for its 50th.
Absolutely.
So thank you very much, Travis.
You got it.
Appreciate it.
Words.